Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. President Bush follows through on a campaign promise of no net loss of wetlands, but a long-awaited executive proposal is leaving conservationists feeling high and dry. We'll have the story. Also this time, Colorado and a wilderness bill. Also this time, results of the recent off-the-grid day.
The amazing thing to me was I've never seen so many solar panels in one place in my life. All around this park, which was probably around a 100-acre park, it was pretty much lined up with photovoltaic solar electric modules from every manufacturer imaginable in giant arrays. There must have been 4,000 or 5,000 solar panels at this event.
John Schaefer, one of the sponsors of the event. Those stories and more coming your way this time on The Environment Show, a national production made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. And this is Bruce Robertson. According to the government's own figures, in its 300 years, this nation has already lost more than half of its wetlands. Only recently, we have come to understand the significance of this loss, not only as wildlife habitats, but as natural flood control and water filtration systems. One of the buzzword phrases in the campaign of presidential candidate George Bush was, "no net loss." The president, in using the term, pledged to create a wetland acre for everyone lost. Well, now, after several years of study and debate, the president has released details of plans to achieve this goal. Michael DeLand is chairman of the White House Council on Environmental Quality and a chief advisor to the president.
We saw when the president first made his statement of that goal on the campaign trail when he was vice president, that we were then operating under a manual that categorized, and depending on whose numbers you believe, somewhere in a rough range of 100 million acres as wetlands. Then before the president took office, there was a new delineation manual that came into effect that substantially increased the numbers of acres so categorized. And the feeling amongst many was that many of those acres that were so included were not functioning wetlands in a traditional sense, did not have the values that you mentioned as a filtration for pollution or flood control habitat or flood control resource or habitat for migratory wildfowl and the like. So the administration has put out for public comment on a 60-day notice period, revisions to that manual that would try and bring the wetlands regulated into the comport with the reality of the situation. In other words, what is a functioning wetland in the traditional sense?
Opponents of the president's plan say this is a question best answered by scientists, but over the years, the issue has become politicized through efforts to legislate protection of these scientifically defined areas. The key piece of legislation is Section 404 of the Federal Clean Water Act of 1972, amended several times over the years. Section 404, the only legislation regulating wetlands, is the controversial mandate that no wetland shall be filled in, except now, by special permit from the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. As DeLand mentioned, in 1989, a federal policy manual was published, expanding the definition of wetlands to include ground that had water within 18 inches of the surface for at least 7 days during the growing season. Well, now it seems the president believes that manual went too far. His recommendation is to classify as wetland ground saturated for 21 consecutive days during the growing season or with standing water for at least 15 consecutive days. And here is the problem, say conservationists.
What's wrong is that it's deleting out tens of millions of acres of true wetlands that are important for fish and wildlife habitat, for flood control, for water quality.
Linda Winter is a wetland specialist with the National Wildlife Federation.
These areas may not be wet all year round, or they may not be wet for 21 consecutive days during the redefined growing season. But that doesn't mean they aren't wetlands, and that doesn't mean they aren't important. And these are areas that scientists and government agencies have recognized as wetlands over the years.
Prior to 1989, it was not mandatory for the Army Corps to take charge of the nation's wetlands. With the release of the 89 manual, the Corps was obliged to oversee wetlands in each of its districts across the country. At that time, the Corps began rezoning land that came under wetlands definition, land previously not considered wetlands. The result was that one day we would have driven by a piece of land considered dry, the next day it was wetland, same land. According to Winter, under the 1989 definition of wetlands, this is as it should be.
You have to have evidence of the hydrology, of the water being present, because obviously you can't have a wetland if the water's not there. You have to have evidence of wetland-loving plants, water-loving plants that like to get their feet wet where their roots are. And then you have to have certain kinds of soils, and there are certain characteristics that show up in these soils that tell you that these soils have been at least saturated for an extended period of time in order to create those changes in the soil.
In an effort to gauge the worth of revising the 1989 Wetlands Manual, a Wetlands Task Force formed under the White House Domestic Policy Council last fall conducted a series of hearings around the nation, taking public comment on the proposals to relax the 89 code. Conservationists claim the public reaction was for strengthening the law to prohibit more than just filling in wetlands, but also dredging, draining, and even flooding. They say the president has ignored the public and bowed to real estate, oil and gas developers, even the agricultural industry. Michael DeLand says this is simply not true.
Contained within the president's proposal is the recommendation that Congress expand the coverage to include dredging and draining, just as you have mentioned. And I must say, admit to a certain frustration, that many of the conservation groups have not examined the details of the president's proposal. And I think if they do, that they will find that it's a balanced proposal and one that, with their help and their participation, does have the potential to protect wetlands in a way that we all agree makes sense, knowing what we now know about their incredible value to our ecosystem.
The president is advocating a number of ways to maintain the no net loss bottom line. The crux of the plan is a three-tiered classification system, whereby certain wetlands would receive even greater protection than presently. Certain others would be re-examined for their qualities. Still others would be released from wetlands designation. Further, a system called mitigation banking would be created, allowing certain areas to have more acreage developed as wetland, thus enabling still other areas to be depleted. Again, Michael DeLand.
I'm confident that this scheme has, or proposal, has the potential to further the president's goal. But it is admittedly complex to administer, and it's for that reason that we are seeking an 18-month review period by scientists both within and outside the government. It's going to be less than easy to categorize wetlands, to make the distinction between those that are in the Class A, those that are in Class B and C. Similarly, if you get to a mitigation banking scheme, you have all sorts of less than easy questions, such as are you to trade amongst categories of wetlands, and if so, what are the trading parameters? Do you require that 2 acres or 4 acres or 6 acres of a Class C be offered up for 1 acre of Class B? And all of those are less than easy questions. But it's for that reason that we're giving ample time for the public to exhaustively review and comment on this proposal.
Linda Winter says she does not believe the administration's stated intent that the new proposals are simply fine-tuning the 1989 code.
Their real agenda, we feel, is to delete out millions and millions of acres of wetlands at the behest of the oil and gas industry and the realtors and the American Farm Bureau so that it's easier for them to make a quick buck. So that's what's really going on. And unfortunately, it appears that the administration has proposed a very weak no net loss policy, one that we actually feel is a net loss of wetlands policy.
Linda Winter, a wetlands specialist and legislative representative with the National Wildlife Federation in Washington, D.C. We also spoke with Michael DeLand, chairman of the White House Council on Environmental Quality. The period for review will continue for 18 months, during which time scientists, congressional leaders, and the public will have a chance to study and react to these proposals. This is Bruce Robertson. Here's a poem read by the poet, Richard Grossman, from his recent anthology of poems titled The Animals. First, a little background.
This poem, Loon, is actually an indigenous poem because I'm an indigenous Minnesotan, and the loon is the state bird of Minnesota. Half the bars in Minnesota are named the loon. But in any case, the loon is an absolutely beautiful bird that swoops across Minnesota lakes. And one of the phenomena that I associate with the loon is that it's very hard to pick out a loon in the dawn light, but you hear it. And because the loon is basically down against the surface of the lake, you can't pick it out sometimes for the pine trees in the background. You hear it, and then you look for it. But you have this kind of disembodied sound of the loon. And then you're looking around, and you're confused. But it's as if something had shattered something, some like primal message had shattered the peace of a Minnesota morning. And you hear it, and it's the cry of joy in the morning. It's an incredible cry of joy. So I wanted to write a poem about that, breaking that kind of sheen of the lake and quiet, and hearing the sound of the loon in the morning crying for its mate. Loon. Morning mist rolls along the surface of the lake, far north, where the wind is a soft breath of desire for a clear day. The pines await my echo, a bodiless form shattered by the light, a loon sound screaming for a loon through the cold, resistant quiet.
The Loon, from an anthology of poems titled The Animals, read by the poet Richard Grossman. As Grossman tells us, the anthology is in the form of a pastoral, where the animals tell us about their lives being animals. The Animals is published by Gray Wolf Press in St. Paul, Minnesota. For the first time in nearly a decade, Colorado senators have worked out a compromise wilderness bill. Democrat Tim Wirth and newly elected Republican Hank Brown support water provisions that deny federal control. But as Leslie Lomas reports, the legislation has spawned debate and could have lasting implications for the West.
The Wirth-Brown bill would preserve 640,000 acres of wilderness in areas high atop the Colorado Rockies. All the proposed areas, except one, are in high headwaters locations, where the rivers begin that run through the mountain canyons and provide water downstream for farms, cities, and industries. Water in national wilderness areas is generally controlled by the federal government, which can claim rights to keep water flowing in the streams to preserve the wilderness environment. But Colorado water users adamantly oppose federal water rights, and the impasse over this issue has held up wilderness legislation since 1983. This year, Democratic Senator Tim Wirth agreed to deny the federal government water rights in order to create a bill that his Republican colleague Hank Brown would also support. But that explicit denial of federal water rights is intolerable to the environmental community. For example, Todd Robertson of the Colorado Environmental Coalition calls the disclaimer an assault on the basic idea of national wilderness lands.
That's dangerous not only to protection of these areas, but also sets a very dangerous and, we feel, harmful national precedent towards the integrity of the national wilderness preservation system.
But Jim Martin, an aide to Senator Wirth, says the bill includes other provisions that provide just as much protection to wilderness water.
One is that it expressly prohibits the construction of a new water project within any of these new wilderness areas. Second, there is a provision in the wilderness bill that the two senators introduced that would limit existing water facilities to their current or historic use so that they couldn't be expanded or changed in the future if that would result in injury to the wilderness areas.
But the Environmental Coalition's Todd Robertson says the provisions are not sufficient.
This language is ambiguous. It says, no, new facilities may be built, but what about expansion of use in existing facilities?
While environmentalists say a federal water right is essential for protecting wilderness, water users are absolutely opposed. They regard federal water rights as obnoxious meddling in state affairs, even though the proposed headwaters areas are often inaccessible and largely unsuitable for development anyway.
You have to understand the whole battle is about future downstream Bureau of Land Management wilderness areas. And there are 400,000 acres right now under study, low down in Colorado on the rivers near the state lines.
That's water lawyer Gregory Hobbs, who has represented water users in wilderness negotiations. What water users fear, he says, is that if the federal government were given water rights in the headwaters areas proposed in the Wirth-Brown bill, that same provision might be made for future downstream wilderness.
It would strangle Colorado's ability to change water rights or to develop new water in the future.
There is one downstream area in the current Wirth-Brown bill, the Piedra Wilderness, which Hobbs sees as a kind of pilot example for future negotiations on the BLM lands. The bill sets up a cooperative arrangement between the U.S. Forest Service and the Colorado Water Conservation Board, the only state entity allowed to hold in-stream water rights. Greg Hobbs sees this arrangement as a good test of whether state and federal cooperation can adequately protect wilderness water. But Todd Robertson is afraid that the state's allocation of water will not be nearly enough to sustain the wilderness environment.
All the Colorado Water Conservation Board protects are cold fishery values. That's essentially enough water to keep the back of the fish wet. They're saying that's going to be adequate to protect wilderness values. We completely disagree with that and question the prudence of trusting a state agency that the state legislature can modify its purpose, abolish it, or whatever at any time.
Despite environmentalists' objections, the Wirth-Brown bill passed in the Senate last week. Wilderness negotiations now move to the House of Representatives, where the debate over water rights, as well as the amount of acreage proposed for wilderness, is expected to be more contentious. I'm Leslie Lomas.
Leslie Lomas reports for the High Plains News Service, a production of the Western Organization of Resource Councils, based in Billings, Montana. John Schaefer says the response was more than he ever expected. Schaefer is president of the environmental supply goods company, Real Goods, in Ukiah, California, and he and his company planned and carried out the first annual Off the Grid Day.
We came up with the idea last January of the first national Off the Grid Day, and at the time it was kind of a fantasy of getting the whole nation to shut down their power lines for just one day. We really had no idea how successful we'd be because we only had 5 or 6 months to really prepare for this and had absolutely no national organization behind us other than a couple people on staff here. And we enlisted the help of the SEER Organizing Committee, which is the Solar Energy Expo and Rally, to help us with promoting the event locally. And we began to promote it on a nationwide basis. So our original goal was to get about 1% of the people in our territory in Northern California to shut off their power breakers for one day to dramatize and the need for more solar energy in this country and just show people what their true dependence was on the electrical power grid and fossil fuels.
So tell us, it was scheduled for 12 noon on August 10th. Tell us how it all worked out. Tell us what happened at 12 noon.
Okay, the event was scheduled to begin at high noon on August 10th, which was this past Saturday, and in order to start the event off in Willits, we had our local congressman, Frank Riggs, came up on stage where all of the organizers and all of the attendees of the fair, of which there were approximately 10,000, came up for a little demonstration where the congressman came up and officially with one giant power breaker took the whole event completely off the power grid and put it on the sun. So for one quick moment, we all counted down from 10 to 1 as if it were New Year's Eve, and the breaker was broken and all the electrical power was completely cut from the event. The amazing thing to me was I've never seen so many solar panels in one place in my life. all around this park, which was probably around a 100-acre park. It was pretty much lined up with photovoltaic solar electric modules from every manufacturer imaginable in giant arrays. There must have been 4,000 or 5,000 solar panels at this event. So all of the booths, of which there were about 100 booths, were completely powered by the sun. So if a power outage had been going on that area, it would have been lit up like a Christmas tree. I mean, we had water pumps, fountains, hydroelectric power plants. They had some electric kaleidoscopes powering 12-volt refrigerators. It was an amazing sight to see. It went on through the night all the way up till midnight, as well as a complete collection of solar electric automobiles. It was an incredible event. There was also the world's first hydrogen car, which was a car that will run 100% on hydrogen, the only byproduct of which is water, which you can drink right out of your exhaust pipe. And Dr. Billings from Missouri, who invented this car, was there with the crowd. And in terms of the peripheral effects of it, we had pledges from between 5,000 and 10,000 of our customers who would sign the Declaration of Energy Independence and also pledge to go off the grid for that one day. Now, this wasn't just in Northern California, but this was all around the country. So all of our employees shut down their power lines, the ones that aren't already off the grid. Here at our operation at Real Goods in Ukiah, where we typically will take between 400 and 500 orders a day, we had the system set up to be 100% off the grid, where all of our telephone system, our 42-station computer network, and our complete telephone system was taking orders. Our operators were taking orders without the benefit of any kind of electric power here. And we even went up to a couple parties that night after the event to houses, and it was interesting. We were driving up to try to find this one employee's house, and we saw all the cars parked out there, and someone pointed out, "That can't be the house. There's no lights on in there." And all of a sudden, all of us chuckled and realized it was off the grid day, and there were strictly candles going on inside the house.
Off the Grid Day was sponsored and monitored by the regional utility Pacific Gas and Electric, considered by some to be one of the more progressive utilities in the nation. Curiously, Schaefer says PG&E supported the project.
It was encouraging that PG&E didn't take this as an adversarial relationship. In fact, there were a couple of people at the fair who were questioning why PG&E was really there, and because 10 years ago it would have been just that question: what is a power company here doing that's building more nuclear power plants and trying to increase the nation's appetite for electricity? What are they doing at a solar event like this where we're trying to decrease that? But I think it's kind of a testament to how things have turned around in the last 10 years. Now they're out there saying we're going to be deriving 10% of our power from solar energy by the year 2010, and what can we all do together to reduce demand? They're out there sponsoring rebate programs and buying compact fluorescent lights for people to decrease consumers' energy demand so that they don't have to go out and build those nuclear power plants and coal-fired plants that are spewing out more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. So I think it is a good marriage of industry and conservation.
Mm-hmm. John, say that it would be difficult for Pacific Gas and Electric to measure specifically the effect of taking however many would go off at that particular event, mm-hmm. Because it was spread out over a number of zip code areas. How would you measure the success of the day, though?
Oh, I would measure the success of the day mostly in terms of awareness, and I think that awareness was greatly increased. People that had never heard the term off the grid were suddenly coming up to each other and asking them if they were going off the grid, and it became the in thing to do for the day, to go off the grid and experience life without power. So just the net effect of the incredible publicity that we got with all the major TV networks up here and all the radio interviews that we had on the major networks was gratifying to me to see that many, many more people were educated as to getting off the grid, what it means, glorifying the solar pioneers that are doing it already. So to me, the event was just a tremendous success.
John Schaefer, head of Real Goods Company in Ukiah, California. He says he hopes the event will build nationwide on the order of Earth Day. In fact, he hopes that by next year, enough citizens will participate to send a message to the presidential candidates. This is Bruce Robertson. Well, that's our show for this week. We hope you enjoyed this edition of The Environment Show. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. For a cassette copy of this program, call 1-800-767-1929. That's 1-800-767-1929. Ask for The Environment Show, number 85. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its contents. Dr. Alan Chartok, executive producer, this is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York.